Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Greetings and welcome to our kingdom. This is Under Consultation, an episode podcast guide through the UK's greatest video game challenge TV show, Games Master. I am one of your hosts, Luke Owen,
attempting to control my balls.
And welcoming you once more
onto the breach,
I am Ash
Versus.
This episode aired on the 1st of October, 1992. Our number one film at the box office is... and top of the charts is...
So yeah, so that wraps it up for the magazines for this.
And now let's head on over to Games Master and find out what our...
For this week's first challenge, I thought I'd test your nerve on Marble Madness. The... ...to a series of mazes. So get rolling and don't lose your marbles.
Welcome to the Games Rig. This is Under Consultation, an episode-by-episode podcast guide through the UK's greatest video games challenge TV show, Games Master. I am one of your hosts, Luke Owen, not to be confused with Eddie Honda.
And lumped together and ready to go under the cosh, I am Ash Versus.
This episode aired on the 1st of October, 1992, and our film at the top of the box office is City of Joy.
Why did you come here, Max?
Right out. Big mistake.
If you're not empty, how can you be filled up?
Nana, Junior. Welcome to India.
Where am I?
You're in the City of Joy.
Is it geographical or spiritual?
Yes. Yes, it is. But also, man, where have the past, 4 or 5 months gone?
I know, right?
I know. It feels like we were literally recording last week. I can't believe that it's been 4 or 5 solid months since season one.
So much has changed.
Yeah. I've got a beard.
Autumn has rolled round.
Yeah.
We've got Butlin's jackets on.
We've got Butlin's jackets on, yeah. Although not the most stylish thing that we will see in this upcoming series. I have notes.
So, City of Joy, what can you tell us about it, Ash?
Can we talk about something else? Can we continue to talk about the change of the season?
No, we have to talk about City of Joy, I'm afraid.
Okay, directed by Roland Joff. Is it Joff or Joffe?
Joffe, I believe it is.
Directed by Roland Joffe, starring Patrick Swayze of Roadhouse. I love Roadhouse.
Great film.
Roadhouse, easily my favourite Patrick Swayze movie. I'm doing anything possible to avoid talking about this movie. But it's a story of a rural farmer who moves to Calcutta with his wife and children. And also Max Lowe, played by Patrick Swayze, also moving to Calcutta from Houston. yada yada yada, misfortune, mugged, thugs.
Yeah. It's no.
Look, I'm going to just cut to the chase. I'm not even going to bother reading the full synopsis for this. This is a white savior movie. I have distinct issues with it.
Yeah.
And it's nothing to do with being woke or anything like that. I just find it really, really offensive. And even at the time, I wouldn't have been the only one. A number of people found it offensive, including the government in the country in which it was being filmed, who tried to block them from filming.
It's Oscar bait nonsense.
It is Oscar bait nonsense. When they were filming, by the way, they had riots.
What, in Jakarta?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, they had riots and there were public protests and firebombs and
bloody
stuff.
Hell.
But they were determined to shoot in like the real locations. But the objections from the government were because they were worried that the film would kind of reinforce that image of Calcutta, mainly as city of Mother Teresa and missionaries. And Mother Teresa and the organization that she set up and followed was actually the beginning of the concept of, to a degree, volunteer holidays and poverty tourism.
Mm. Yeah.
Because you'd go along, backpacking, volunteer, and then once you'd done some volunteering, you'd go and spend some time in the city.
Yeah.
Well, yes, it did some good. It's also a little bit exploitation-y and not something I'm a huge fan of.
Mm.
However, they did get to film in the city for what they needed, but they couldn't do full-time production there. So they went just outside the city to the docks and spent $7 million building a slum.
Okay.
Almost 70, 80 buildings. But for authenticity, they went to the original slum, the actual slum, and offered new metalwork and doors to the people living there so they could take their old tin roofs and doors to make their set authentic.
Mm.
Bunny ears in action.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, as authenticity goes, it looked right. They also gave them the option to do floods during a rainstorm, which they'd have had a difficult time doing in the real streets with any degree of control. But I don't like it.
Mm.
And so therefore, can we talk about Roadhouse?
Or we could talk about what they went on to next. Because the next year, these two are going to be involved in a movie that is tied into what we're currently doing for this show. Because these two people are responsible for the very first video game movie in Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah, because that's when you think of Super Mario Brothers, what you think of is you want the people behind this movie in the Killing Fields.
Yeah, well, Nintendo did. Like, that was one of the reasons why Nintendo went with Joffe and Evers, is because they were going to bring a much darker tone to it. Like, they were pitching. The other side as well is that Joffe and Ebert literally went to Japan. So when Nintendo put the feelers out that we're going to do a movie based on Mario, you know, everyone called Paramount, Disney, Sony, everyone called, but none of them went. And Joffe and Ebert, well, Joffe in particular, went to Japan to meet with them in person with loads of tea and said that it was a very expensive trip. But he spent less doing that and his original pitch, because his pitch was $500,000 for the rights, whereas everyone else was pitching like $5 million. Mm. But so his doing $500,000 and just flying over in tea was way less than what Disney and Paramount were pitching outright. And that's how they got the deal. That's how they got it, because they went and met them in person. Oh, we're going to take this direct quote from a book called Lights, Camera, Game Over, How Video Game Movies Get Made.
I've read that. It's a good book.
Oh, thank you very much.
It's available on Amazon.
Oh, yeah, it is. And other good book retailers. So Joffe said in it, they looked at the movie as some sort of strange creature, Joffe says, intrigued to see if it could walk or not. Ryan Hoss, SMBMovie.com fan site founder and webmaster, adds, Joffe essentially said, I'm here and they're not. I think the way he approached pitching his version of the movie to Nintendo is what won them over more than money. Nintendo didn't care. What Nintendo did care about was how the producers would handle the property. English-born Joffe was the man behind City of Joy and The Killing Fields, while Ebert also came from a background of adult-orientated dramas. With three of the top-grossing films of 1990 being family entertainment adventures, Nintendo was keen on a kid-friendly approach. However, their American office, headed up by the notoriously belligerent Minoru Arakawa, was keen on Joffe and Ebert's darker approach. This wasn't Snow White and the Seven Dinosaurs, Joffe said. The dino world was dark. We didn't want to hold back. The idea of taking a dark take on what would essentially be marked directed to children, had come off the back of the mega success of Batman in 1989. Director Tim Burton had adopted a much darker tone than previous adaptations of The Dark Knight, and this proved to be effective, grossing over $251 million domestically and propelled Burton into a hot commodity. It's amazing how many people I spoke to about the production of Super Mario Brothers all said, "We were trying to do Batman." That was what their blueprint was for the Mario Brothers movie. It was Batman, which had come out, you know, 3 years prior.
Okay, Batman dresses in dark clothes, uses the emblem of a bat, swings around a violent and corrupt city. Dark and gothic is natural. Mario. You see where I'm going
here?
Yeah. It's a case of they really wanted that square block to fit the round hole, and they just needed to find a hammer that was going to make it cooperate. And fair f*** to them, they did. They found it. I was trying not to swear, because as much as I enjoy listening to you cover my swear words with sound effects, I thought, I'll try and make your life easy. But no, fair f***. They found someone that could do it. And Mario Brothers now is a cult hit.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, at the time, it wasn't. It was critically panned. It was commercially...
A disaster.
It was a disaster.
It certainly didn't help that it came out 2 weeks before Jurassic Park.
Yeah, a proto-Yoshi is not going to combine with the full might and majesty of the Stan Winston Creature Workshop.
Absolutely not. If you want to know more about the making of Super Mario Brothers movie, obviously, you know, my book is available and it's out there. But also, Best Movies Never Made recently did some podcasts. I say recently, it's recently at the time of this, we're recording this, but it's been like a month or so by the time this podcast actually comes out. But go find it in their archive, because they do a two-part, I think, on it.
It's a two-parter. They also act out segments of script with a really remarkably good Bob Hoskins Mario impression. You get to hear all about the various drafts and the ideas, including at least one where it was essentially the Mario Brothers in Rain Man.
Oh yeah, Drain Man.
Drain Man, there we go. It's worth checking out. Heartily recommend.
Yeah, that was when they actually had Dustin Hoffman in line to play Mario, which was then shut down by Minoru Arakawa, who didn't think that he would fit the role. He also said that Tom Hanks couldn't play the role either, which is how Bob Hoskins eventually got the role.
Tom Hanks would have been a good Luigi.
Yeah, at the time, in particular, he'd have been a great Luigi.
I'm thinking, yeah, big era, Tom Hanks.
Yes. Yeah. And our number one song at the top of the chart. Oh, it's a banger. It's Ebenezer Good by The Shaman.
Oh, my God. I can't wait to see what bit chiptune version of this you find to lay in the background.
Well, I'll tell you this. It'll be naughty, naughty, very naughty.
I love this song. I still love this song. I think my parents were a little bit too straight to actually realize what it was referring to, for which I'm eternally thankful, because it means I didn't get in trouble for playing it repeatedly.
It's a banging tune.
Yeah, it's an amazing tune, and it's also amazing that it got as much success as it did, because when it was first released, it was banned by the BBC. Always a mark of a quality song.
Yeah, it was banned by the BBC and Mixtape. We're going to try and like spread out our thoughts about this song, because we've got this for, what, 4 weeks? I think it's at number one before it gets pulled.
Yeah, because a band pulled it because it was ruining their release schedule. It's like, we're going to be competing with ourselves with our next single.
Yeah. But it's an absolute...
Wet never did that.
No,
bloody should have.
Yeah, absolutely, they should have done. I was sick of hearing that Amiga cover of that song.
I tuned it out by the second episode. I was just like... It was just kind of the Magic Roundabout theme instead.
So we'll go into that in a bit more detail, because what I want to talk about, you know, we kind of joke that it's been a while since we've got together to talk about this. But in, you know, the timeline that we're covering the show, it has been six, eight months.
Hmm.
And we've missed some big old releases in the world of video games. So I just wanted to cover a few of these.
Please do.
In the time since Series 1 ending and Series 2 starting, April saw the release of the Super Nintendo. May 5th saw the release of Wolfenstein 3D.
Without Wolfenstein 3D, I don't think video games as they are today would exist, for better or for worse, because... Wolfenstein 3D led to Doom. Doom led to a massive burst in the home PC gaming market. It led to Quake. It led to 3D accelerator cards. It led to 3D graphics cards. It led to Unreal Tournament. It led to Call of Duty. It kept pushing further and further forward. At that point, what was pushing games forwards graphically, particularly in the 3D arena, were flight simulators. And suddenly with Wolfenstein 3D, with Doom, with Quake, with that entire lineage of first-person shooters and first-person games right up to this day, they were more accessible than any flight simulator ever was.
And if we're going to keep on recommending things, I heartily recommend Masters of Doom, which is a fantastic book telling the story of the two Johns and how they got together, how they then created ID and how they created or id Software and how they did Wolfenstein 3D and Doom, their eventual split. It is a fantastic book. I highly recommend it. July 29th saw the release of Echo the Dolphin for the Mega Drive.
Echo the Dolphin, possibly the first actively eco video game. We've had Top Banana. Boy, have we had Top Banana.
Oh, yeah.
But this had a strong message with actually fairly solid gameplay behind it, led to a couple of sequels, and the last one of which was for the Dreamcast.
Yes, yeah. Crazy game as well, about time travel and going and meeting dinosaurs and all sorts of stuff. But I think a lot of gamers listening to this podcast will remember that first time you play Echo the Dolphin and working out what the f*** you're supposed to do at the start of that game, because it gives you no hints.
You just swim around, like, butting things and firing off sonar, but there's no real preamble or story or, nope, or anything that will give you a guide and direction. It literally drops you in at the deep end.
September 1st saw the release of Championship Manager, a game that I've got a lot of fondness for.
I never got into it, but I admire the longevity of the series because it's still around in some form today.
I think so, yeah. Champ Manager 2, 96-97, that was my era. That was my favorite version of the game.
I could just never get into all the stats. It was at that point where I was beginning to drift away from football.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And lastly, the big releases. September 2nd saw the release of Art of Fighting.
Ah, yes, SNK, the often imitators to the Capcom Street Fighter crown.
But often people will say that they are the True Fighters company, because that's where you get Art of Fighting and Fatal Fury. You've got to master those games in order to be good at them. Whereas Street Fighter, as we will sort of see as we get into this episode, is a game that anyone can play, and then you have to be good in order to master it.
Yeah, I would argue that I think Capcom have the right idea.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Because I don't want a fighting game to be easily won by button mashing, but also I don't want to struggle just from first pickup. However, I do have a lot of time for SNK. I did own Fatal Fury for the Super Nintendo, and I have a deep love, as flawed as it is, for World Heroes. Because those characters were bonkers.
Yeah.
And there's a new Samurai Showdown either out or around.
Yeah,
or,
I think so, yeah.
I would love for them to sneak in some old World Heroes characters as DLC, because I don't think there's enough love for World Heroes to warrant a new game. But I wouldn't mind seeing a few of the older favourites again.
And just to run through some of the movies that we've missed at the box office, we try not to go into these too much so we can get into the episode. We've got Hook, Basic Instinct, Batman Returns, Lethal Weapon 3, and Alien 3 were all number one at the box office.
Man, we missed some amazing movies to talk about.
And we come back to City of Joy, and next week is bloody Spotswood. Spoilers for next week. Rhythm as a Dancer by Snap was number one in the charts while we were gone. Jimmy Nails, Ain't No Doubt. But let's give a big shout out to Right Said Fred, Deeply Dippy.
They knew how to write a banging pop ditty.
Yeah. Deeply Dippy's a great song as well.
Yeah. Contact Sport, Let the Neighbours Talk. He's talking about butt sex.
So before we get into our first challenge, should we talk about the fake opening to Series 2 and what they were attempting to do here?
Upset people.
Thank you very much. Yes, we're back at last after five fallow months, welcoming you once more onto the Breach, dear friends, for the best in video game entertainment. So for tonight's first challenge, let's renew our acquaintance with the great man himself, the Games Master.
Greetings. How nice to join me once again. For this week's first challenge, I thought I'd test your nerve on Marble Madness. The object of the game is simply to guide the marble through a series of mazes. So get rolling and don't lose your marbles.
And attempting to control his balls on this challenge is Mark Hopfield from...
So what happens is we get the same opening of Series 1, the same opening graphics, and then we get a shot of the church and we get Dominic Diamond still into that church. I'm doing Bucky O'Hare ears.
Yeah, he's had a haircut between shots, but we'll leave it at that.
And he says that, you know, we're welcome back. We've had 5 months off, but once more into the breach, dear friends, it is glitching. And a little warning comes up saying, do not adjust your set. And then the first challenge is Marble Madness. But then it very quickly starts cutting out and a boot up screen appears saying that level one's expired and terminated. Level two is now loading. And that's when we get our new intro. But it wastes about 2.5-3 minutes.
It kills. When you consider the runtime of an episode, including opening and closing credits, is about 23-24 minutes. And particularly in season two, those closing credits are long.
The opening credits are long as well.
Yeah.
That helicopter flies forever.
I know. They made the mistake going out to the games rig because the commute is a bastard. In retrospect now, it is odd to see this kind of sign coming up saying, do not adjust your set to interference. Because we don't get that now. A channel is either on or briefly, it's off.
Yeah.
You do get breakdowns of some channels. It's happened to a few of the TV stations I watch, Challenge TV mainly, because I am stuck in the past.
Well, how else are you going to watch countless hours of Bullseye?
You've literally nailed what we spend most of our time watching on Challenge TV.
At least you got the double top there.
Oh, always got the double top. But it was a thing that happened, particularly, I think, with Channel 4 and BBC Two. Channel 4 mostly, because Channel 4 always was a little bit low budget.
Yeah.
But you had this thing, because we were using analog transport mediums, these big tape machines, they overheated, the tape stretched, it snapped. You would have problems with local transmitters or the relays to the local transmitters. So seeing this come up wasn't unusual, and I would wager that some people watching this had already seen this happen for real in their region during season one.
Yeah, yeah. So I watched this episode for the first time in, you know, a long, long time when I was on that plane back from Japan. And I watched like pretty much the entirety of series one in one sitting. And then I watched the first two episodes of series two. And when series two started, I was like, huh, I don't remember it still being in the church. That's weird. And then it came up with the little messages. And because, you know, these were YouTube rips, I was like, oh man, is this the YouTube rip that we've got? One with technical difficulties. That's a bugger, isn't it? And it took me far too long to realize it was on purpose. And as soon as it's revealed that it is one big joke, I was like, I'm a darned fool that I absolutely fell for this at the age of 34. They got me. They got me hook, line, and sinker.
I am a little bit disappointed, though, because I really wanted to see this Marble Madness challenge with Mark Hopkins of Work Skunk. But we will never know whether Mark manages to maintain a firm grip on his balls because the signal breaks down and we get some lovely pastoral lambs.
Yeah.
With easy listening guitar.
It's very nice, really. It's quite tranquil.
It is. It's more tranquil than what's about to come.
Yeah.
Because level one has expired and level two is now loading. And by God, it's proper loading times for that era because this opening sequence does take a hell of a long time.
But check out those graphics, eh? 3D graphics.
There is a definite leap in budget. You can tell they've had a bit of extra cash, not only because of the increased complexity of the title sequence, but the Games Master CGI rendering stretches all the way to the edges of the screen now. It doesn't just reach the cutoff point for overscan and stop.
Very, very nice. And what a huge difference it is as well when you've got this huge set, this ginormous, like, stacked upon stacked set, and kids are packed to the rafters in there. Dominic Diamond spends another 2 minutes running down steps so he can introduce the show, wearing his lovely red Butlins jacket.
But when he finally makes it to the stage, he welcomes us to Games Master 2, The Second Coming.
Thank you, and welcome to Games Master 2, The Second Coming. Each week we'll be ferrying challengers and other minions out here to a converted oil rig stroke holiday camp combination. Here they'll face rough seas, howling winds, and the verbose vernacular of the Games Master.
Starting strong.
Oh, we're starting strong there.
And says each week people will be ferried out to their gaming rig / holiday camp destination.
I think it's a really fun setting for the show. And I think it is the one that's the most memorable as well of all the settings that we get. Maybe it's because I think this series has the most episodes out of any of them.
It's 24 episodes.
Yeah.
We're in for a fairly long run. Season 3 is not much shorter.
No, I think that's about 50-odd episodes. At least it feels like 50-odd episodes.
50-odd episodes, but condensed down to 22.
So let's get into our first challenge of Series 2, our first proper challenge, not Marble Madness. So what have we got, Games Master?
Greetings, and I'd like to take this opportunity formally to welcome you to the Games Rig. As you can see,
I've undergone something of a facelift since our last encounter. Please bear with me. If to begin with, I seem a little disconcerted by some aspects of my new environment. Good Lord. I must say, for my part, I'm thrilled to be back so that we can resume our little communions. Nothing beats a good grapple. So for my first challenge, I've opted for the unorthodox pugilism of Street Fighter 2. The object of the game is to inflict terminal damage on your opponent in a best-of-three fight contest. The dirtiest tactics tend to pay the greatest dividends, so lots of unseemly conduct, please. Second out.
Hey, this ain't no Series 1 now.
Pack things up, we can go home. It's not going to be peaked for this season.
Oh, things are different now. We punch people now. This ain't no Panzer kickboxing. This is Street Fighter bloody 2, mate.
Although I wager, because obviously I've watched it, there'll still be the same amount of whiffing of moves.
So yeah, Games Master welcomes us to the game rig. He's had a facelift since we last saw him. You can hear seagulls in the background from his helipad. And a little bit of fire comes out from a pipe. He goes, good Lord.
I wonder what they told him was going to be there. But also, he was good in the first season. There's a bit of pep in his, in his presentation. He has some fun from this point onwards. I guess because he's maybe now seen episodes, so he knows what he's dealing with, even if he doesn't always necessarily understand it.
So it's a very simple challenge for Street Fighter 2. Pick your opponent, batter the hell out of the other one, and win the best out of three rounds. Very, very simple stuff. It's just, it's exciting because it's Street Fighter, and it's Street Fighter 2 on the home consoles.
Yeah, this is a Super Nintendo version, which has often been described as an arcade-perfect conversion. Yeah, yeah, really lots of bunny ears because...
Big Buckio hair ears.
Oh my God, there are so many differences. There's people missing from the backgrounds, there's voices missing. But despite the fact that it really wasn't arcade perfect, you know what it was? Groundbreaking.
Damn good is what it was.
Rage quitting started with Street Fighter 2 on the home console.
Yeah.
And it was also, for a good amount of time, it was the killer app for the SNES over the Mega Drive because... SNES had Mario, that's okay. Sega had Sonic. A lot of games were multi-platform. A lot of games had equivalents in style, if not in name. There wasn't, for a good chunk of time, a Street Fighter 2 for the Mega Drive.
Yeah, not until they got the Special Champion Edition. And even then, when it got that, it was hampered by the fact it was a three-button pad. So you had to, if you wanted to play it properly, you had to go out and get the six-button pad, which is extra money on top of that. And it's really funny, like, for the next year or so, we are going to see Sega release so many Street Fighter imitators that are going to be, this is our version of Street Fighter. This will be our Street Fighter beta. And absolutely none of them are until they get Special Championship Edition.
Do you know what? They released so many imitators to Street Fighter, I'm amazed SNK didn't sue them for gimmick infringement.
Well, we scoured the arcades trying to find the best two fighters on Street Fighter 2. So please welcome Henry Coleman Jr. and Peter Deitch.
Welcome, Henry. Welcome, Peter. Right, now, I'll turn to you first of all. Henry, I know you two have had a couple of practices together. Who's been coming out on top?
Well, it's like evenly matched, really. You can't really tell.
Okay. Right, so what character are you playing tonight?
I'm choosing E Honda.
Eddie Honda? Yeah. And why is that?
Because of his country hand slaps, sweeps, and close range to bear hugs, so I can drain his energy down.
Okay, then. Right, Peter, who are you playing to counter Eddie Honda?
I'm going
to
be Ken today.
Okay, what are we going to see from Ken
see
then?
Dragon punches, sweeps, all types of moves, slams, everything.
If you'd like to take your places, we'll get ready to play.
And our two competitors are Henry Coleman Jr. and Peter Deitch. They've had a couple of practice fights, and Henry says they're quite evenly matched. And he's picked E Honda because of the 100 hand slap and the devastating bear hug, while Peter has picked Ken because he's a basic bitch.
Hey, as a Ken player, you're right. I mean, Ken, there's a joke of you literally fight like a flowchart because it works. It's a very, very, very easy character to get to grips with. I find it interesting that he listed E Honda's bear hug as a finishing move.
Yeah, he says that later on. And it's so wonderful because that's how I would have described it back in the day as well.
Whereas if you look at it, how it fits in with the canon of Street Fighter moves and the set of moves that every character has, it's just the throw.
Yeah.
Or the equivalent of the
throw. That's his throw, yeah.
He has two. He has the over-the-shoulder throw with one and then the bear hug with the other.
Yeah. And the throws are, like, those are the big damage dealers in Street Fighter 2. If you can master doing a throw, you're all right. You're onto a winning. Because you could do, like, almost half damage with it.
It is a high-risk move, though, because you have to get in close. They have to have their guard down, but you also do as well.
Yeah.
There's that microsecond where if you miss the grab, you leave yourself wide open and it's game over.
Yeah.
One thing I will say as we start to get towards this is not the PAL edition of Street Fighter 2. This is the American NTSC version, as best as I can tell, which is an impressive get. If it is the PAL version, then they must have some friends in high places at Capcom, because this would be a pre-production board or pre-release cartridge.
I'm pretty sure this is the NTSC version. I think, like, in one of the shots, you can see one of them lift up the controller, and I'm pretty sure I can see purple buttons.
Also, it is actually, the picture, I think, is full.
Mm.
Whereas we would have had some letterboxing over here because of shonky PAL NTSC conversions.
Yeah.
Do you remember when those were a thing?
I know. I was going to say, really, we should have been listening out for the music, because if it sounds like the music that we now know,
you know
it's the NTSC version, but unless you want to hear the sort of half slowed down version, then we're like, oh, cool, it's PAL.
Although, good luck hearing that music, because by jingo, this crowd is rabid.
Aren't they just?
And helping me out in the commentary box is a street fighting expert, Nintendo Hotline's own Keith Poulin. Welcome, Keith.
Thanks a lot, Dominic. Good to be here.
Thank you very much. Now, Keith, we've got Eddie Honda against Ken. What are some of the special moves for people who perhaps don't know the game at home?
Okay, E. Honda has a 100-hand slap,
right?
Which is a series of very fast punches coming in a short amount of time.
And what about Ken? What's he got?
Ken, he has very aggressive low kicks.
Okay, we'll look out for those.
Before we get to that, Keith Poulin, who works for the Nintendo Hotline, is in the pulpit.
That's a weird one.
Isn't it just? Keith takes audience members who might not know what Street Fighter 2 is through the various moves that each of the characters are going to do. And he says Ken has aggressive low kicks. And then he's about to say something else. But Dominic Diamond's got no time for him. And he's like, sorry, mate, we've got a challenge to do. Let's fight.
We wasted nearly 3 minutes with a fake out intro. We don't even have time for the mandatory joystick waggling jokes.
There's no time for you, Keith. So let's get into the fight. Ken immediately busts out some hurricane kicks, tries again, but Honda slaps him down. Honda kicks Ken loads, and he wins. He's one up nothing.
One thing I did notice is the game time has been set forward, because this game is running quite fast. That's not counting down in seconds, that's half seconds.
Yeah. Into the second round, Peter misses some dragon punches, but tries to repeat some, and then goes for the tried and tested method of jump, kick, and sweep.
Yeah, jump, medium kick, hard kick, sweep.
Yeah.
Now, I said this before we started recording, but at the time, this was mind-blowing, because this was Street Fighter 2 being played on the television. Nowadays, you look at it, and it's like, man, this is appalling Street Fighter 2 gameplay, because we're at a point now where Street Fighter, in many of its iterations, is a major competitive esport. The concept that you might have only two dragon punches in a match, and they both miss, is laughable. I do have some sympathy, because confession time, I played loads of Street Fighter 2 on the SNES. I could never truly master the Dragon Punch with the SNES controller.
It's a tricky D-pad to do it on.
You give me a joystick, you give me a Mega Drive style D-pad or one of the Mad Catz fight pads if we move forward towards Street Fighter 4, no problem. Rolling them out all day. But that SNES joypad, I gave myself blisters on that trying to get the roll.
It's a tough bugger.
For the D-pad.
Yeah. Actually, I mean, I was playing it literally the other day, playing Street Fighter 2 in the office, because we've got our mini SNES in there. And I had a round with Ken. And I was like, actually, getting out these dragon punches is not easy.
I think also, and some people have said this, the games do get more forgiving as they go on.
Yes.
Because they want them to be more accessible. And also, they're less concerned with taking your coins.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, Street Fighter became a bigger hit in the home market than it did in the arcade.
Yeah, it's incredible what a big game that this was around the time. But to your point as well, that this is, like, it's mind-blowing to see this on Games Master. And I got such a kick out of watching this back. But if you compare this to how people play Street Fighter now, because it's not like you can go anywhere now and see people play Street Fighter 2 averagely. Because the only time you're ever going to see people playing Street Fighter 2 competitively is if they're dead good at it.
Mate, you should come and see me play Street Fighter 2. I will give you all the average you need.
I don't mean like that. Is it like in a public forum?
No.
You're not going to see people playing averagely at a tournament. That is just going to be full of people who are wicked at the game.
Yeah, I mean, in fairness, they've had 30 years to get good at it, so you'd hope.
Yeah. I went to a screening of the Street Fighter movie that was an interactive screening, in that anytime a fight broke out in the film, they would pause the film and then would switch over the SCART to Street Fighter 2 on the Super Nintendo of the fight that's about to take place. So you would do like Chun-Li and Bison, you would do, I can't remember like the various fights that they do. And I got up to play one of them. I played as Bison, and boy, howdy, did I suck. I was like, Bison's my guy. That's who I play as on Street Fighter 4. I'm going to nail this. And I sucked donkey dick at it. I was dreadful.
I think that was one of the things I remember about when we got Super Street Fighter 2 for the SNES, or when you got the Championship Special Edition for the Mega Drive. For me, those final four bosses, Bison was hard. Sagat was the one that always got me. It took me longer to get past Sagat most of the time.
Yeah, he was a tough bugger.
Than it would pass Bison. And I was like, finally, now the power can be mine. I can be Sagat. I can be that badass that no one can be. And you know what? I stunk as Sagat. My favorite character that my love for is always outweighs my ability to play as him is Vega, or Balrog, for those of you that are shouting the correct names at the podcast, because he was so radically different. He was also the only Street Fighter with an actual weapon.
That was why he was my favorite too.
He also just looked badass. Looked, he had cool, a man. Mask, he had the gloves, he could climb the cage. Yep. It was so cool.
It was really cool. So I don't know if we've got through the second round there yet.
It's mediocre.
Dominic Diamond at one point claims that sumo is not a recognized sport. And then E. Honda starts fighting back from a major deficit, but Ken takes him out with a punch. We even get a replay for that punch.
It was a slow motion replay. I like that. But the thing is, it wasn't a dragon punch. It was just a punch.
It was hard punch.
Yeah.
And then into the final round, we're one apiece. Honda dives into a dragon punch. Dominic Diamond keeps calling for the fat sumo bloke to do better. Ken throws a couple of fireballs. This is all Ken. And then Honda comes back.
Oh, Honda had slap, but lovely. He's pulled right back into this game.
He's done. Can he finish him off here?
Oh, my God. He's got the dead level. Winner.
That fiery babyface comeback where he takes it at the last moment, he blazes out some moves, he locks in the bear hug, and it's just all over. You see the energy being sapped away. Boom, done, 2-1.
It was all about that 100 hand slap. He got the 100 hand slap in, and from there it was game over for poor old Kenneth. He gets wiped out with that bear hug. What a great finish. Superb opening challenge. I loved it.
Also, I love the name of the challengers, because Henry Coleman Jr. sounds like a boxer.
He does.
He sounds like he should be good at this game, and you know what? He was.
Yeah, he really was. And I really like Peter as well, because he sounds like me and my mates back in 1993 and 1994 talking about this game, where you want to sound like you're the one who knows the most about this game because you might have read some article in a magazine somewhere. So you would say something like, yeah, it's all about the bear hug. That's Eddie Honda's special finishing move.
Let's go to you first. Peter, a really good comeback there from you. You were out of it in the first bout. Talk me through it.
Well, when the second bout, I kept on coming in with flying knees, cyclone punches, and a couple of sweeps, and I thought I'd finish him off there.
Okay, then let's go to our champion, Henry Coleman Jr. Now, Henry, what on earth were you doing at the end of it? It looked very rude.
Well, it was sort of like Eddie Honda's special finishing move, a bear hug. He just basically comes up to them, grabs them, then drains their energy, and I was counting on that for me to be the victor.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's balderdash.
That is absolute balderdash.
Dominic Diamond calls it shake and vac action, and we've got the first winner of the Golden Games Master joystick in Series 2. It's back, it's bold, and a deep sea diver is presenting it.
Not Dave Perry in that wetsuit. They did employ a model to do this job, and they're like, cool, you look great. Here's a wetsuit and a diver's mask and a hood. And at least they didn't make her wear the flippers. I did. When she first started to walk up the stairs with the joystick, I'm like, please let there be flippers. Because just the idea of them employing this model, and then for a game so obsessed with joysticks and innuendo, to essentially have a model with sex appeal then be put in some of the most unflattering clothing possible. It was beautiful. But anyway, the first challenge is over. A wise move in having two people fight for the joystick, yes, where there must be a winner, because it means you're starting,
great point,
with a winner no matter how it goes.
Tonight we take your grey cells for a gentle jog as we look at Brain Game. First up on the Mega Drive, the Simpsons marketing machine trundles along in Krusty's Super Funhouse.
Krusty's Super Funhouse is a brilliant game. It's got a unique combination of lemmings as well as a bit of platform to beat. You have to guide a load of rats into a trap, which may sound pretty dull, but because the levels are so massive, it keeps you going for ages.
I wanted to see more levels, and I was intrigued and inspired to try and solve the levels. Although it's got very cartoon-style graphics, which you would think would aim at children, because of the size of the levels and the puzzles, it appealed to a very wide audience.
Because we wasted so much time at the start of this show with its, you know, fake-out intro, we've actually only got time for two reviews this week, and it's Brain Games. Kicking things off, though, with Krusty's Super Funhouse for the Mega Drive.
Which is a real die-hard two of a game, because guess what? This wasn't even a Simpsons game to begin with. This was a game called Rat Trap.
Yeah, for
Acclaim.
The Amiga.
Yeah, yeah, the Acclaim. They got the license for the Simpsons, and they're like, what can we slap this IP on? Which, you know what? It's entirely in keeping with the Krusty character, I feel, because in the canon of the Simpsons, Krusty slaps his name on any old sh**. Same here.
Yeah.
Although it's actually a fairly good game.
Yeah, I really like Krusty's Super Funhouse. I never owned it myself, but a friend of mine had a copy, and I remember going around to his to play it a couple of times. And I would be very interested to go back and play it again, because, you know, they compare it to Lemmings on here, but it's also got platforming elements. You're guiding rats. It may sound boring, but the levels are so massive, it can keep you going for ages.
Tell you what, play a drinking game this episode. Take a shot every time they compare something in this review section to Lemmings, because whether it's accurate or not, they will do it.
Yeah, we should say, actually, our three reviewers are Alex Simmons from The Control Zone, Max Francis, and John Davison of Mega Drive Advanced Gaming.
I do not remember that magazine at all.
Absolutely not.
There are some magazines that come up here because, spoilers, we've lent heavily on archive.org's humongous possession,
yes,
of magazine scans. Some of these gaming magazines just don't exist there, and it's very difficult to actually find any evidence of them anywhere.
The game got released for the Super Nintendo as well. Super Play gave it 79% and wrote, it's actually pretty good fun to play, although perhaps more of a younger player-orientated game than anything else. Not one to set your heart on fire, but a solid game nevertheless. Which kind of, I think, it feels reflected in this review as well, because Max Francis wanted to see more levels in the game, and John Davison says that the graphics look like a kid's game, but the level size makes it appeal to a wide audience.
Still, a respectable 87% on
the
review.
Good, man.
That's pretty strong to start with, unlike the next game.
Next, block-building, clock-beating, fluffy creature-saving action on the Amiga, courtesy of Troddlers.
Troddlers on the Amiga at first seemed to me to be a Lemmings rip-off with a bad control system, but after I'd played it, I realised it was exactly that, a Lemmings rip-off with a bad control system.
The puzzles look a bit nicked from Krusty's, and the Troddlers just are nowhere near as cute as Lemmings. I'm sorry, they just don't work.
Troddlers is a very dated game. The graphics are very 80s, and the gameplay is excruciatingly dull.
Yeah, unlike Troddlers on Amiga, I've written here, this looks like a total Lemmings ripoff. And then Max says, it's exactly a Lemmings ripoff.
I'm going to be controversial. I'm going to disagree, because while I think there are definitely similarities to Lemmings, Lemmings doesn't actually have you control an on-screen protagonist.
No.
I'd say that is a fairly key game difference. It doesn't make the game good, but it does make it different.
Interestingly, PC Gamer gave it 82%.
What did they know?
Maybe the PC port was better than the Amiga version. But John Davison says the puzzles have been nicked from Krusty's, and the Troddlers are nowhere near as cute as the Lemmings, and Simmons calls it an 80s game. It's the 90s now, dudes! 46%.
Yeah. There was a Super Nintendo port of this eventually,
yeah,
which actually tied in with the Super Nintendo mouse, but that port did actually make it more of a Lemmings ripoff, because you were no longer controlling either Hocus or Pocus on the screen. You were waving a mouse pointer around, much like in Lemmings.
Yeah.
Now it's time for this week's new game section, and we open the series with the first TV shots of the most eagerly awaited sequel of all time, Sonic 2. Yes, he's back, and this time he's got a friend. The Green Hill Zone has suffered a mutant revamp, with the cheeky chappy bouncing off all kinds of angled springs and twisty walkways. In one-player mode, Sonic's newfound amigo Tails will help him collect those rings, while the split-screen option allows two players to compete in an orgy of hyper-fast frolics to the finish. If you thought the Spring Yard Zone was bruising, feast your eyes on Casino World.
Oh,
And finally, it's disappearing sonics and Tubes Ahoy in the polluted play area of the chemical plant zone. This game is unfeasibly fast and looks set to slip into the slots of Sega owners everywhere.
And for our new game preview section, it's Sonic the Hedgehog 2. And it's funny, I was talking to a future guest on the show, Dave Bulmer from Sonic the Comic, the podcast, that it's weird that we have done this first series of Games Master in a pre-Sonic 2 world. Kind of like, you know, now in 2020, where it's just like, you look back at the Mega Drive era and it was Sonic 1, Sonic 2, Sonic 3, and Sonic and Knuckles. To look at an era...
Hey, don't forget Sonic Spinball.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And Sonic Spinball. I had Sonic Spinball. I got it for Christmas. And we were just a Sonic the Hedgehog only kind of world. There was no Sonic 2. And so this preview here, where you're like, Sonic the Hedgehog is getting a sequel, it feels mind-blowing.
Yeah, this was part of the big build-up to the game, which would eventually result in Sonic Tuesday.
Yes. Which is next month, actually, in the timeline. And Dominic Diamond says this is the very first TV screenshot of Sonic 2, calling it one of the most eagerly awaited sequels of all time.
He's not wrong, and he's not wrong.
Yes, and it's interesting as well, because this obviously doesn't translate into the audio version of this unless you've watched the episode. But when you watch the episode, the first thing you know is like, well, that's not the right title screen. And then you got Dominic Diamond talking about the Green Hill Zone has had an update where they're showing you Emerald Hill Zone instead. And you're like, huh, what's going on here? It's all very, very weird that they're talking about these things, but these, now, you know, we know those two don't really correlate.
I think this comes into where we are in the development of Sonic 2 and where preview builds and footage was coming from, because Sonic 2 was allegedly due to have some of the time travel aspects of Sonic CD.
Yes.
And the whole idea that Green Hill Zone was then going to be Emerald Hill Zone, there was going to be different names for different periods of time.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, did some of this come from the point when that was still a thing? And then, of course, it would be ported over to Sonic CD with its time travel aspect.
So this version that we're showing is footage that was likely shown at the New York Toy Fair in 1992, because the title screen from that version is the same title screen version that we see in Games Master here. But Yuji Naka revealed later in life that someone stole that prototype from the Toy Fair. And then, mysteriously, around about 1992, this prototype was released on sort of primitive internet. It was shared around for people to make hacked Mega Drive cartridges released of this prototype version of Sonic 2, which does have more of the thing you were talking about there, which is more of like, not so much the time travel elements, but the zones were called different things. They had different music. Like the aquatic zone opens the game. Like that's the first level.
The thing I love about this is not that it was stolen, but the fact that it was stolen and was released onto the internet at that time means we can get that ROM now and we can play that sumbitch.
Absolutely. It was called the Nick Arcade prototype that was released in 1992. And then Simon Y distributed a better version of that prototype in 1999. So the theories are that the Aquatic Ruin and Emerald Hill Zone and Green Hill Zone, as you say, are like of the future and present version, and Hilltop Zone is the past version. Either way, Green Hill Zone appears in both of the ports.
Yeah, I do actually like the evolution. Hilltop, Green Hill, Emerald. It does feel like a nice escalation of names. But also, there were some deleted zones on there.
Yeah, I've got a table here that Sonic 2 was planned as a time travel story. You would start in present time, and then Robotnik escapes by time machine, and you go to medieval time. Then you go to the present time in a ruined version, like Back to the Future Part 2. Then you would travel back to the ancient time, and the future has changed again, and you have the last battle in space. And I've got a list of all the zones of what would be the various different versions.
There is no way that plot would have actually translated into a Mega Drive cartridge.
So it's a very interesting feature and a very interesting part of this show, just because like it's crazy that we're only a month away, you know, 2 months away really from the release of the game. And yet we are looking at a very different title screen from the one that we actually got on November 24th on Sonic Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
Right, well, let's get into our celebrity challenge hunt. Here's Games Master to tell us what it is.
Hello again. It's time to don our raincoats with some gumshoe drapery on Who Shot Johnny Rock. Tonight's challenger, turned detective, has three lives with which to survive shootouts in the pool hall and the casino in his attempt to foil the mafia hoodlums responsible for the death of Johnny Rock. Good luck. I'll be rooting for you.
Well, it's another Laserdisc game.
Yeah.
Yep, it's
another American lasers game.
Yes, Who Shot Johnny Rock? Yeah, I haven't really got much to say about this one. It did get a 3DO port, which Electronic Gaming Monthly gave 4.8 out of 10.
It had a Sega CD port as well.
Oh, did it?
Yeah, and PC. PC got the mouse support, which is not really to be surprised.
Yeah.
It was originally called Who Killed Johnny Rock, but I guess they thought, we better make it a bit more family friendly, even though you're essentially gunning people down with glee abandon.
Yeah, and you don't want it to sound too much like, well, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, I suppose. And actually, that was originally titled Who Killed Roger Rabbit.
No, I think they exactly wanted to sound yeah. like Who Framed Roger yeah. Rabbit.
So you've got to get through the pool hall and casino with three lives. And our special guest this week, our celebrity guest this week, it's only Tony Bloody Slattery.
And indulging in some sharpshooting skills tonight, we are very lucky to have one of the funniest men on television. Star of the music quiz, Whose Line Is It Anyway? S&M and That's Love. Please welcome Tony Slattery. Now, Tony, do you actually play video games?
No, I absolutely hate them.
Okay, well, all the more gentlemanly of you to come on.
Introduced as one of the funniest men on television, and he's not far wrong. There was also the joke that essentially he was on anything he was asked to be on, and that his actual answering machine was just him saying, I'll do it.
I mean, that's quite clear from this as well, because the first thing Dominic Diamond says is, do you play video games? And he says, no, I absolutely hate them.
I love his delivery on that. Dominic Diamond tries not to let it rattle him too much. He says, oh, it's very gentlemanly of him to come on, and says that this game isn't a game, however, it's more of a way of life, and asks Tony to play it in the style of a Prohibition era private eye if he can.
Because Tony Slattery was on Whose Line Is It Anyway and things like that. So I think that he thought that we might be able to get him to do some improv while playing the game. But Tony's got no time for that. He just wants to ask about his jacket.
Says, are you attending a wedding after this?
Now, this isn't so much a video game, Tony. This is more a way of life, this game. So we'd like you to play it in the style of a Prohibition private eye. Can you handle that?
Of course I can. Yes, that goes without saying. Are you going to a wedding, by the way?
Perhaps afterwards. Who knows, Tony? Maybe you and I. We don't know. If you play your cards right.
Massive slam on the red coat. Right out. Dominic Diamond says maybe afterwards. Who knows? Maybe him and Tony if he plays his card right. Now, Tony Slattery is gay, but this was not public knowledge at this time. He's actually been with the same partner since the mid to late 80s, but he was very firmly in the closet for a number of reasons. One is public opinion because of the way it was treated still at the time. Also because he didn't want his parents to know, although he thought his mother knew because she always referred to him as her bachelor son. One thing I just want to get out there before we get on with the challenge. Tony Slattery was a mainstay on television. He was on so many different panel shows, quiz shows, game shows. Whose Line Is It Anyway? Win, lose, or draw?
I think he must have been on
he
that.
He must have been on that. Unfortunately, he also succumbed to some of the excesses of celebrity life. Alcohol, drug abuse, massive cocaine problem, and bombed out quite spectacularly. Also, some undiagnosed mental health issues. It led to a massive fall from grace. There is an article out there, an interview with him from The Guardian. I think it was done last year, 2019. I would recommend you go and read it because, one, it is an immensely informative piece on where he's been and what he's been up to. It's also tragic.
Okay, well, if you want to see if Tony plays his cards right on this game tonight, then join us after the break.
You may be looking for a car that's small and practical, but you still want a car that feels luxurious. Well, now you've found it, because while the Clio is certainly small, it's perfectly formed. The Renault Clio.
Super Nintendo Entertainment System. You won't believe the power. You won't believe the control. You won't believe the jumps, the curves, or the feeling you get until you experience it for yourself.
Whoa! That's fast!
F-Zero for the ultimate G-Force, only in the next generation from Nintendo. Now you're playing with superpower.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Sorry.
It'll take more than that to wake her. A proper cup of Tetley should do the trick.
She's stirring.
So am I.
It's all right. It's Tetley.
Oh, Sydney, my little prince. It's the best cup of tea I've had in years.
Welcome back. We have Tony Slattery here tonight, and he's about to try his trigger finger out on the arcade game Johnny Rock.
We come back from the ad break, and Tim Boone of CVG is in the booth with Dominic Diamond. They point out that Tony Slattery doesn't really like games, but Tim's like, well, he'll like this one.
It's optimistic. Yeah. He'll like this one. He gets to kill people with wild abandon, because when you think of Tony Slattery, you think of mass
murder. Yeah, he said you've got to look for clues by shooting the bad things and avoiding the good things. Very sensible advice from Tim.
It's good advice. It's advice for life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, with me also is Tim Boone, the main man from CVG Magazine. Welcome, Tim.
Hello, Dominic.
Now, Tim, any tips for Tony on this game? He says he doesn't like video games, so what advice can you give him?
He's definitely going to like this one. Basically, he's looking for two clues, one from the portal, one from the casino. This is basically Gangster Central. And what he has to do is look for these two clues by shooting everything bad and not shooting everybody good. Okay. What he's going to need for this is he's going to need quick wits, nerves of steel. He's going to need quite a bit of luck, and he needs to be good with the ladies. So I think he's the right man for the job.
Okay, then. Tony, are you ready?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Patricia.
Okay, then. Can you take your pistol out of your holster and begin the game?
You fast piece. All right, I will.
And Tony Timon then says, take your pistol out of your holster. And Tony very much picks up on this double entendre.
Yeah, he's like, right, whip my dick out. Got it.
So this is your very bog-standard laserdisc game where you're watching bad actors do bad acting for a long time and then you get to do some action. But there is, I feel like there's more action in this one than we got with Mad Dog McCree back in Series 1.
Absolutely. It comes a lot more thick and fast. But it's also a very different style.
The problem we have, though, is that when you fail on this game, like if you get shot, the whole scene replays over. So what we essentially get to see is Tony fail at this thing and watch him fail at it multiple times.
It's Groundhog Day in video game form. Also, just an aside, does Tony call Dominic Dominic at any point during his challenge? Because just when Dominic asks if he's ready, he goes, I am, thank you, Patricia.
Yeah, I did very much like it. The first time he gets killed, he goes, that woman shot me.
Yeah, he is morally outraged that this woman shot him. But it's actually a clever ploy on the part of the game because you wouldn't expect it. He looks legitimately shocked.
Yeah.
Whether the shock was a first-time reaction, I don't know. They must have let him play it.
Yeah.
And so he'd have seen that. But given someone as talented at recall and improv as Tony, I'm sure that his reaction the first time it genuinely happened would have matched up with that.
He gets through the first bit on his third try. I think he eventually gets through the first section of this, then gets into the second one. Basically, the way he gets through the first bit, he realizes, is just to constantly fire. It's just to hold down the fire button and eventually you'll get through it. Just shoot anything that's on screen.
Thankfully, in the first section, there isn't anyone innocent to hit that we notice. So, yeah, it's a valid ploy. But especially on repeated watching, the acting in this, even if you look at it as a pastiche, the acting is so cheesy. Like, you know, if you go to a decent takeaway pizza, you get a four cheese pizza.
Mm.
And you can put maybe a stuffed crust.
Yeah.
And then maybe cheesy garlic bread. I'm hungry now. But guess what? Cheesier. Cheesier than that. So at the end of the first level, just before we go on to the second level, the casino section, because we go from pool hall to the casino, there is a brief interlude where there's a woman pushing a baby carriage. And the baby carriage opens. And it's an angry short man with a gun.
Yeah.
It is literally the stuff of my nightmares. And he no-sells it and just shoots him.
Yeah. In fairness, thankfully, Tim Boone was there to really foreshadow it. He was essentially going, watch out for the carriage! So in the second section, he avoids shooting one of the good ladies and shoots two other guys. But then, unfortunately, shoots an innocent right in the face. His challenge ends in failure.
Bad luck, Tony. But, I mean, you were going so well. You only had about one or two more people to bump off, but you bumped off the wrong person.
I know. Well, I think success isn't everything. It was all these women in low-cut dresses appearing from nowhere. I mean, how am I meant to concentrate?
I completely understand. Now, unfortunately, Tony, you haven't won our special Golden Games Master joystick, but if I can patronise you for a second more and ask you, have you enjoyed yourself anyway?
I think the game is absolutely brilliant, and I'm not an aficionado, but I could well become addicted to that.
Okay, that's lovely. Well, you've been a brilliant sport tonight. Round of applause, please, for tonight's special guest, Tony Schlatter!
So, I thought Tony was a good sport. The game's fine, I guess. But I thought Tony was a really good sport about it. I thought he looked like he had some fun with it.
Yeah, knowing what we know and what we mentioned about Tony's life and where he probably was at this point, he definitely throws himself into it with much joy and plays up to it. He's probably one of the few people I can think of that really just went toe-to-toe with Dominic and actually kind of upstaged him.
Yeah.
He had a very strong manic energy as part of his stage personality. And there were a couple of times where I almost felt like Dominic stumbled a bit because they were kind of throwing backwards and forwards. And I don't think it's that it was unwelcome. I just think he wasn't used to it because normally he's speaking to shoegazing children going, yeah, I was.
Yeah. And during the first series of this, it's been all sports personalities, with the exception of Pat and Mick.
Yeah, who, again, went toe-to-toe with him, and where there was an option for a dick joke, they sometimes got to it first.
Yeah, exactly. They reckon that he was one or two people away from winning, and he blames it on those bloody women and their low-cut dresses distracting him.
He was still firmly in the closet at this point. He was still firmly his mother's bachelor son. But it does make me wonder, how out was he in show business circles?
Yeah.
Because there's also a couple of comments right at the beginning where I think it's Tim Boone is saying, oh, he's got to, you know, shoot the bad guys and charm the ladies.
Yes.
And he's certainly the right man for the job. I don't think that would have been said as a mean-spirited joke, but I did wonder if it was a bit nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
It's one of those things where you watch it back in retrospect and you do think, oh, I wonder if there had been some discussions backstage or if, like, even, you know, just sort of offhandedly someone saying, like, oh, have you heard actually about Tony?
Well, he had a long-term partner at this point. Yeah. He'd been with his partner, I think, for 4 or 5 years.
Yeah. So I reckon people must have known.
But also, as we've seen recently in the news, it's a sad indicator of how difficult it was to be out at that point in time.
Oh, completely. What I do love about Tony here is he goes into, I'm not shill mode, because that makes it sound like a very negative thing, but I just really appreciated him then being like, do you know what, actually, video games are brilliant, and this game's really good. I could see myself getting addicted to that game. Total bollocks. Like, he doesn't, you know, really mean a word of what he's saying, but he's got so much conviction behind what he's saying. I think it's actually quite lovely.
Yeah, it's a lovely tale of love lost and redemption and a burgeoning addiction to shooting people in a video game.
Yeah. Right, well, let's head on over into the consultation zone, or is it the consultation chamber, Or is it, as Games Master calls it, his consultation area?
Or is it the pad?
Either way, we're heading there now.
Hello, Games Master.
Welcome to my consultation area, up here on the helipad. How can I help you?
I can't find the Blue Switch Palace in Super Mario World. Can you tell me where it is?
Ah, that old chestnut. The Blue Switch Palace can only be reached from Forest of Illusion 2. There's a deceptively placed illusion wall toward the end of the level. Simply walk straight through it.
Thank you very much.
That's quite all right.
Ooh, this is much more breezy than last year. We're on a helipad now.
Yeah, no, I don't like it as much. Actually, no, I love it. I think it's great.
I love the oil rig conceit.
It's
I love
so
the fact
good.
That we are in different zones every season. We've got some interesting ones to come, but I think this is the best.
When people think of Games Master, I think this is the Games Master they think of. Like this and Series 3 Games Master, the design of him, this is what people remember of the show.
Weirdly, I think some people actually mix it with Season 1 settings. So they're like, why was there a church on an oil rig? In fact, I'm fairly certain I've had that discussion with people since we started this project, because they were like 5 or 6. And they're like, oh yeah, it was that church in the middle of the sea. And I'm like, Season 1 and Season 2, but close enough.
So close. Our first kid is stuck on Super Mario World. Spoilers for the rest of this series. This game is going to come up a lot. This and A Link to the Past are going to be brought up a lot in the consultation zone.
And justifiably so, because Mario World is an easy game to play. It's a difficult game to master.
It's a difficult game to 100%. Like, to get all those exits.
I still don't think I've 100%ed this, and I've played it on multiple platforms at multiple times, but I'll still go back to it because it's still a great game. Also, probably this will be the second or third time I mentioned it. Yes, we know it was called Super Mario Brothers 4.
Thank you, Damien.
And Andrew, who's probably listening as well. Yes, we know it was on the Japanese box. No, we didn't look at the Japanese box artwork.
No.
Get off our back!
I do know for a fact that I have 100% of this game, because when they did the...
I know,
this is a bit of a humble brag, this. But you know when they did the Game Boy Advance re-releases of them, and they were called like Mario Advance Series, and one of them was Super Mario World, and that actually had a percentage tracker, so that you knew if you'd found all the exits, if you'd got all the Yoshi coins, and you'd got all the hidden areas and everything. So that's the only way I know that I've 100%ed this, because I did it on the Game Boy Advance version.
Oh, nice. See, now you've got it in me, and now I'm like, I'm going to get that loaded up and I'm going to complete it.
Oh, my classic SNES is in the office, and I've been spending my lunch times replaying this game. And I am thinking to myself, do I want to 100% this? Particularly because while we're watching this show, it's going to come up so often. I almost feel like I should now, because they're telling me where everything is. But this kid can't find the Blue Switch Palace in Super Mario World. He needs to go to Forest of Illusion 2 and then walk through the wall into a hidden exit.
He describes it as an old chestnut. And I'm like, well, maybe in your dimension, mate.
Brand new here, lads.
Hello, Games Master.
Hello, and just what is your particular problem?
Could you please tell me how I could beat my friends at Game Boy Tennis?
Practice the game, young man. Failing that, you can always cheat. When it's your service game, throw the ball high, but instead of striking it truly, step beneath it. If the ball lands on your head, you'll have won the point without raising a sweat. Not terribly sporting, but hugely effective, I can assure you.
Thanks, that's great.
Our second kid can't beat his friends at tennis for the Game Boy, and Games Master gives him the 2019 advice of get good.
In fairness, it's valid advice, because the option he gives him will likely result in a boxed ear or two from his friends.
If you were doing this over and over again, because the cheat is, as you've just heard, is when you throw the ball up in the air, if you walk slightly underneath it, it will hit you on the head and you just get the point. If you're doing that in a two-player game, that's a dick move.
That is really a dick move. That's almost as much of a dick move as something that someone I grew up with did, which is multiple times when playing versus Tetris on the Game Boy with the link cable.
Yeah.
If they thought they were going to lose, they would accidentally pull the link cable out.
No.
Dick move.
Dick move.
Hi, Games Master. Could you tell me if there are any special bonus areas on Zool?
Oh, I'm rather pleased you asked this one. The zoo actually includes a special Games Master secret room full of goodies for your consumption. The room is located on the third level of the suite world. Simply walk straight into the first right-hand wall you come across, then you will reach the reward.
Thanks a lot.
And our final gamer wants to find hidden areas on Zool. Games Master's very excited to tell him that there is a Games Master themed special area that you can find.
What are the chances of that?
What are the chances?
Pretty goddamn high.
Yeah. We're going to talk more about Zool next week because we've got a challenge for Zool next week. So we're going to talk a bit more about the game on that episode.
Is it too spoilery to say we've got a guest?
No, I think we can say we've got a guest.
We've got a guest.
Yeah, we've got a guest. We're very excited.
Yes, joining us for the entire episode.
Yeah, yeah. Really, really awesome. So it's time for our final challenge, and let's head on over to Games Master to find out exactly what it is.
Finally, for the night, I've opted for an arcade game, which I hope will tickle your fancy. It's called Dragon's Lair 2, and I'd like you to complete the first level of the game and reach the time machine without losing a life. Do watch out for the mother-in-law, an overweight old Hannibal who would like nothing more than to spot you with her rolling pin. I guarantee the act will be fast and furious, so brace yourselves for a picaresque adventure.
So we're playing Dragon's Lair 2, The Time Warp, I believe its full title was.
Yeah, we're getting our mileage out of Laserdisc games this week. Bloody hell.
They had one supplier that they knew, and they're just like, here's loads of them. Use all of them.
They were expensive machines as well and very difficult to transport because quite often the Laserdisc mechanism was kind of semi-sealed, and if it got out of alignment, it was done.
Yeah, I remember there's a really interesting book. I think I talked about this when we did Dragon's Lair on a previous episode. We did a Laserdisc game on a previous episode. I think it was Mad Dog McCree, in fact. And the developers of games would make them, ship them out to companies, but would often spend more money getting them shipped back and fixing them and shipping them back out again. Because in transit, the Laserdisc would go all skew-iff. By the time it gets to the arcade, it doesn't work anymore. So yeah, Dragon's Lair 2 came out, nearly 10 years after the original. It's crazy to think how early in the arcade boom Dragon's Lair was, because it was nothing like everything else that was in the arcades in 81.
Yeah, I mean, development started in 1983 on this sequel, and it says a lot that it took 8 odd years to get out there. You'd have thought they'd have kind of really pushed it, like to rush it, because Dragon's Lair, the original, as you said, there was nothing like it to capitalize on that success. But unfortunately, by the time it came out, the sheen had gone away a bit because they'd also had Space Ace in that time.
Yeah, Space Ace came out in that time, yeah.
Because Mad Dog McCree and all its various brethren from American Laser Games, they were all over the arcades, assuming they survived shipping. But I remember seeing Mad Dog McCree right around, and I don't really remember seeing Dragon's Lair 2, even in the same arcades that would have those other Laserdisc games. My local Laser Quest and Megazone and the places that would become my local arcades, they'd always have a full motion video shooter, but Dragon's Lair 2, less so.
Yeah, I don't think we really had any of the full motion games on the Laserdisc games in my local arcade. I will recommend actually a book, as we like to do on this podcast, it's a book called Generation Xbox. And they've got a full chapter on like the history of these Laserdisc arcade games. It's really, really good.
What are we recommending books for? This is a video game podcast.
Sorry,
about a TV show and soon a magazine. Never mind.
But Dragon's Lair 2 was going to get home ports of the game. They were announced for the Saturn, the Philips CDI, the 3DO, and the Jaguar CD, but only the CDI version actually made it to release. And Computer Gaming World described Dragon's Lair 2 as an exceptional program which suffers from uninteresting gameplay, with the magazine criticizing it for being too much like its predecessor and just being a long series of trial and error instead of actually testing players' ability. It's QuickTime events. It was basically a whole game of QuickTime events.
My whole opinion on QuickTime events has changed drastically. I remember when they first started to make their way into modern gaming, I was very much of the group of people that was like, no, get it out of here. Give us proper gameplay. Nowadays, I'm much more mellow because I actually think it can allow game makers to put incredibly high tension sequences in, which still involve the player to some degree,
yeah,
rather than just being a flat cutscene.
Yeah, completely.
A couple of great examples that come to mind is the first Tomb Raider reboot. There's a couple of QTEs in there which I think are absolutely brilliant, particularly the one where you're kind of like skidding down a slope and it's quite a horrific fate for Lara if you miss them. Games like Until Dawn, where QTEs are absolutely key to a lot of the game mechanics, but because it is more of an interactive movie, it kind of fits. So yeah, I've mellowed.
Yeah, I very much like them in the Until Dawn side of things, where they're like, they essentially have consequences.
And taking a magical skip down fantasy lane on this challenge is one of the best arcade players we've ever seen. So please welcome from Portsmouth, Dougie Johns. Okay, thank you. Now, Dougie, we've seen you in action. We know you're one of the best players around, but this game is very tough. Can you do it?
Well, yeah, I think with my superbly home game playing skills, I should be able to walk it.
Okay, we've got a very plucky competitor there.
Taking a magical skip down fantasy lane is Dougie Jones, who is going to be competing. He's got to complete the first level of Dragon's Lair without losing a life. They call Dougie Jones one of the best arcade players in the country, and he's bound to be, because he's from Pompey. I am the Pompey. That's where I went to university.
Ah, okay.
I nearly moved there, in fairness. It's where I had legit the best job of my life working. Aside from the job I have now, I used to work in the game station in Portsmouth. And I was just working there with my friends, and we were just playing games and just talking a load of crap all day long. And it was absolutely brilliant.
I actually briefly, when I was at college, had a job in a local game shop, but I only talked to people when they came in because it was a very small and very sketchy game shop. It was mainly used games. Occasionally we did get new games in, but also above the shop in a room was a massive bank of VCRs and a monitor.
Yes.
Now you're thinking, ooh, bootleg films. No, the other stuff.
Oh.
Yeah. There were plain brown bags with videotapes in under the counter. And occasionally the boss would come in the morning, go upstairs, puts them down under the counter and says, oh, if so-and-so comes in and asks. And I'm thinking, this is really dodgy. This is really sketchy. But I do get to sit and play Fire Pro Wrestling on a chipped PS1 and I get paid 30 quid a day, cash in hand. So I was fine.
The great days at Game Station were when you would get someone come in who has like, oh, we're just emptying out the loft. And we've just got loads of stuff here, like this big sort of like cardboard box that's full of games. And you would just scan them in. And the best ones were the ones that didn't scan properly. Because if they didn't scan properly, that means they were 50p cash or 99p trade. So I scanned in a copy of Panzer Dragoon Saga, which didn't scan. And my boss was like, the rules are you've got to do this. So we scanned it in and I got to buy Panzer Dragoon Saga for $1.99, buy one, get one free.
Bloody hell.
I know, right?
You lived a charmed life back then.
Yeah. So if you're sitting there listening to this podcast thinking, when are you going to get to the fireworks factory and talk about the game? There's not a lot to talk about because the lad does very well and then he loses.
The commentary in this challenge is barely legible. There's a handful of mother-in-law jokes because truly this entire sequence is one long mother-in-law joke, as well as the occasional shouting of the words holes and snakes.
Yeah.
But look out for the flashes.
Watch out for mother-in-law. Here she comes.
Oh, she's a big girl, Tim.
Out the door as fast as you can because you don't want to mess with her.
She's and now the horse and away you go. And like I would have been following me.
I will say, though, Tim Boone, a bit of an editing error here, wearing a different shirt to the one he was wearing in the previous challenge.
Ooh.
Come on, guys.
Continuity.
Continuity. He's wearing a lovely Star Wars t-shirt.
Okay, forgiven.
Yeah.
Now, Douglas, what happened? We've seen you before. You're a brilliant player, but it's a very tough game, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. The Don Bluth games are, you know, right on there. Split-second decisions and pressure was on and just missed one move.
Okay, well, you've given me personally a lot of pleasure today, Doug, so...
Yeah, the guy just, he makes it really fun. And it's weird because I've written in my notes here, it's a game that's more fun to play than it is to watch. But it is also sort of fun to watch than it is to play, because I don't think it's that fun to play either. It's a weird balance, and it's for some reason it just doesn't translate into watching on a TV challenge.
To me, it kind of falls into the same trap as Guitar Hero and Rock Band, which are two games that I absolutely love.
Yep.
I co-run an event based on Rock Band still now because I love it that much, but I don't see most of the animation and the shtick going on if I'm playing it, because I'm focused on hitting the targets. So as a good example, the Beatles rock band, some beautiful animation, amazing visuals, music videos that would have never existed for the Beatles, but I never see them when I'm playing. No. Because I'm trying to hit the orange notes. I'm not seeing the hillside visage for George Harrison's Here Comes the Sun.
So I don't think this particularly translates. I will give a little bit of trivia about Dragon's Lair, though. Daphne from the Dragon's Lair series was originally scripted to appear in the Adam Sandler movie Pixels.
Man, narrow escape for the Dragon's Lair franchise, then.
The video game character that Josh Gad's character falls in love with was supposed to be Daphne.
Do you know what? I completely forgot that film had a plot.
I will say, I don't hate Pixels.
You're not trying hard enough.
Dominic Diamond says actually that they saw Dougie complete it in the practice mode. They said, we saw you complete it, a couple of times. But Doug says, you know what? Bluth games are tough. I just made the wrong move.
Yeah. He does actually call him Douglas as well. It's like, got real when you lost. You're not Dougie. We're not friends anymore. You're Douglas. You're in trouble, Douglas. Also, that air horn is really annoying in this challenge.
I was about to say, you can tell that we are in the 90s now because
brilliant game.
Is just on and on and on throughout this. Yeah. Oh, yeah, get used to it, folks.
Yeah.
Dominic Diamond says that Doug has given him a lot of pleasure.
Creepy.
Well, we've actually now got on the line a man who wasn't just a contestant on Series 2 of Games Master, he was also the researcher for the show. We welcome to Under Consultation, Doug Johns. Doug, how are you?
Not too bad. How are you doing?
I'm very, very well. Thank you very much. So, yeah, we just watched your challenge on Games Master Series 2, where you took on Dragon's Lair 2. But before we get into that, how did you get involved with Games Master?
Look, I've been in the games industry for a long time. Well, I was a big games fan, so pretty much from when I was a kid, first played Space Invaders on a ferry going across the Channel Islands from the UK. I then worked in computer retail, then moved from that into journalism. So I worked for some magazines in the South Coast called Amiga Action and ST Action. I then, that moved up north. And from there, I then applied for the job on Games Master and got that and came down to London and took part in the Games Master series on the oil rig.
So did you only work on the second series?
Yeah, the oil rig one. That was the only one that I worked on. But we actually did... The company that actually did Games Master, Hewland International, they also did another games program which went out on Sky, which was called Games World, and that ran 5 nights a week. And I moved across to that and did one of those nights. I did the tips night on that. And look, a few people remembers Games World, but it was pretty good.
So just to kind of give our listeners a bit of context, what would you say a researcher does for a show like Games Master?
Look, there was a few of us. There was three of us that were researchers. So we got various things divvied out. And it's usually, you'd be like, okay, you're going to look after the reviews. So speak to the various companies to try and get access to code so you can do reviews. Someone else might be doing interviews. Someone else might be doing, okay, you deal with the talent that's going to come on and do those challenges. So we'd all take our own little bit. I, because I was a big game fan and knew and came from a journalist background, I already knew a lot of the PRs at the company. So I was sort of like certainly helped with getting access to that code. And it was pretty tough, only because, in today's world where, it's not even print, it's really more about online. You can get a game, play it, and put the review up tomorrow. But with us, we were really working on like a 3-month lead time schedule. So you're asking people, back when the games were, that the industry wasn't quite as polished as delivering content, to give you access to a game 3 months, maybe 4 months before it was coming out, which in a lot of examples with reviews, it's like, well, the game's only half complete. So it's made it really, really hard. But yeah, so you get the game in, and then once you've got it, you sort of like play it and record it. And with the reviews, we didn't review it. We'd actually get unbiased people to come in, so games media and stuff like that. Again, because I've been a journo, I sort of knew all the journos, we're all mates. So we just reached out to those people and went, look, do you want to come on and do some vox pops? Just some little quotes, just saying what you think about the game. And put that together. And look, it was good fun. There was a lot of people that were not experienced in TV at all. So I think there was varying levels of success with that. But, well, well, well done to them all, you know, because you don't know what it's like until you're really staring at that camera, and it can really affect people in different ways.
Did you also have, because I think I spoke to someone who was a contestant on season two, who said that they dealt with you. So did you actually, like, were you auditioning people to be on the show?
Yeah, we sort of, yeah. Look, you know, to be honest, if you put your name forward and we grabbed you in, you pretty much was there, because we didn't have a lot of budget or time to play about with. And, you know, there was only a few examples when people come on and just weren't good enough to go on the show. I remember we also did, like, the tip section on Games Master, which is, you know, a kid would come on, stand in a green screen and go, "Hey, Games Master, how do I beat this level on Super Mario?" or something. And I remember one, the kids were pretty good, but I remember just one example where this kid came in. He was from wherever he was. I think he had like a 2-hour trip to get to this studio in London. And he just came up and all he had to do was say, "Yeah, hey, Games Master, how do I beat this thing in this game?" And he was like, "Hi, Games Master." And just couldn't. It was just, and it wasn't scared. It was just too overwhelming for him. You know, he was, you know, he was a young lad. He'd come to his studio, which was like down in the basement, and there was like a whole crew all standing around him with several cameras, and he had to look at this imaginary thing in the corner, and it was just too overwhelming. And he had a good few goes, but it never happened. And we actually cleaned out the whole studio, so it was just him and the camera and one person in the end, but it was too much for him, the poor little sod. But,
oh,
you know,
bless.
I think, you know, it wasn't a polished show on that level, you know, so it didn't really matter. It was for the fans and sort of made by the fans to a certain level. And I think that certainly comes across in it. And again, with, you know, the kids that were coming on and then maybe doing a challenge and stuff, you know, there were some that, you know, were very shy and quiet, and that was fine, but they were possibly the better gamers. And then other people that are a bit more gregarious, but possibly didn't do so well. So it was that, you know, that mixture.
So you said you were a gamer at this time. I'm assuming that's then how you managed to become a contestant on the show as well. But like, how did the idea of you being a contestant come up? Like, how was it broached to you?
Look, you know what? I can't remember. But what I would probably say is that it probably would have been one of two cases. It would have either been someone didn't turn up on the day, and so there was no one to do it.
Right.
Or with Dragon's Lair, it's a game that's actually, you know, if you don't know it, you know, you're not going to get very far. It's you know, simple enough, up, down, left, right, but get your timings right. So I think it was possibly then a case of, this is only going to work if we can actually get through a few scenes. So I got lumped in, but as I remember, I don't think I'd been practicing it very much. We just, you know, the machine turned up and I hadn't had much time. So I don't think I got that far off the top of my head, but it would have probably been one of those two reasons.
Had you played the first Dragon's Lair, or, you know, games of that? Because you also had the Johnny Rock game in with Tony Slattery, which is also in the first episode.
Yeah, look, I had played Dragon's Lair before, but not much. You know, look, I came from Portsmouth back in the day, so I grew up going to coin arcades down by the beach, and, you know, spent a lot of time playing your Donkey Kongs and, you know, Galaxians and Galaga and all that sort of stuff way back in the day. But I always hated Dragon's Lair because, you know, it was only because, you know, it's one of those things, you know, once you know it, trial and error, you know it. But when you're, you know, feeding, you know, what was 10 pence into it then, which, and I didn't have a lot. I might have had, you know, a pound to spend that day. You know, I didn't want to particularly have that blown within about 15 minutes through trial and error. So I didn't play that game very much at the arcades, which probably to a lot of people that are not my age and maybe only about 18 now, probably just sounds like complete gobbledygook what I'm banging on about. But, you know, it was a different time.
I mean, because Dominic Diamond does say during the sort of the post-match that you have that you were great in practice. So did you actually, like, nail the challenge?
He would probably be very kind. Dominic was a good lad, and I think that's probably just a bit of a presenter's bravado being kind to me. But no, and I'm pretty sure I got about 5 minutes to play the bloody thing. And as you say, or as you know, if you're familiar with Dragon's Lair, it's just about knowing, you know, what you have to do on each particular scene, and you have to be quick and get the timing just right. And it was, as it gets a bit later, it's quite an unforgiving game. You know, to be honest, it's quite a bad game. But what was really good at the time, it was LaserDisc, and, you know, you were seeing stuff that looked like a movie at a time when, you know, up against alongside of machines like, you know, Donkey Kong, you know, which it was a totally different level. So it looked great. In terms of the gameplay, yeah, it sucked a bit.
Because you were, you know, a researcher on the show and you ended up being a contestant. And we were pretty sure that happened in series one as well, which very much felt like they were just flying by the seat of their pants to get, you know, the 10 episodes done. But were there other examples of, you know, the crew or people working behind the camera just sort of jumping in to be a contestant in the second series?
Look, the Dragon's Eye one is the only one I can remember off the top of my head. You know, sometimes, you know, we tended to try and avoid that only because it was, you know, we were the crew and it was about the kids and stuff like that. So if it was happening, it was only because there was probably a reason it had to happen, not because we planned it. You know, obviously some of the, I remember there was a couple of contestants who were friends. So it was also back in those days, it wasn't so much of getting your mates in. It was a case of actually getting people to write in. We didn't get a tremendous amount, you know. Pretty much, if you were a girl, you were in, because you know, you'd have like one in every 20 submissions being a girl. And obviously, we wanted to have as much balance as possible. But you know, back in that day, you know, the percentage of female to male gamers was probably quite different. I think it was a lot more male heavy then, even who was actually spending and playing games. But obviously that's a lot more balanced now. It's very close to the 50-50, which is a lot nicer to see. But even now, when you look at, you know, journalists and media, it's, you know, the female writers are certainly that there's less of them. But, you know, it's slowly getting to, you know, a more even balance, which is good.
So Games Master Series 2 was quite a wild ride. You had some incredible celebrities on there as well. But do you have like any, what's your favorite like memory of working on Games Master?
Oh, look, well, if you talk about celebrities, I'd say probably the WWE wrestler, Duggan or Jeff Duggan.
I don't know what his name is. Jim Duggan.
Him. And like the reason I remember him is like there was a few of them that came on, and to the most part, the celebrities are quite nice. It seemed the lower profile they were, the bigger dicks they were. but Duggan came on, and he was the quietest, most timid guy possible. And I remember I was looking after him in the green room. And just saying, you know, how can I help you? What do you need? And he'd be like, just a can of Coke, bud. That's all he said to me. And then they got out there with Dominic and they said, action. And the man went insane, just burst into life and grabbed Dominic and threw him across the set. I think we did a couple of takes because Dominic just didn't know what was going on. The guy just went mental. And the one that went out is possibly a combination of a few takes, but what a... you know, there was a real performer, you know, someone that as he was behind the camera to as he was in front, totally different. And, you know, he was probably one of the biggest stars we had on there because, you know, obviously WWF, as it was then, was really, really big. So that was great. But then, of course, we also had a lot of local people as well. I think if we're going to out people for the ones I didn't like, Michael Fish, the weather presenter. He did one of the reviews and we sort of like... We had a load of, you know, games journalists coming on, people that do not do TV, have not been in front of a camera, are not used to it, and so probably not doing their lines or, you know, being nervous, taking 10 takes, whatever, that's not the end of the world. He was the most unforgiving man in the world and was just complained about the quality of their, you know, TV skills. And it's like, mate, you're a weather guy who massively cocked up with probably the biggest weather storm back in the day. You probably just need to calm down a bit. But yeah, I wasn't a big fan of him.
So we're obviously big fans of the show. We're big fans of everything that went on with it. But obviously, you know, Dominic Diamond is a real stalwart of the series and the franchise overall. Do you have any good Dominic Diamond stories?
Probably nothing I'm willing to say on tape. I haven't spoken to Dominic for a long time, so I don't know what he's doing at the moment. He was up writing for, you know, some of the newspapers in Scotland, and he's around, so I'll be careful about what I say. But yeah, look, now he was a great guy. He used to go out, and we always go out together and have a laugh. You know, I remember one night, you know, going to the pub and playing a lot of pinball, and you know, just having a bit of a competition. And there was a sort of like a punishment for whoever came last, and Dominic had been winning all night and he actually lost, and so he had to go out and do a dare that we told him to do in the Trocadero, but I'm not going to tell you what it is because it was really dodgy. But I will say he did what we dared him to do, so fair play. The guy was he was a good lad and up for a laugh. But I'd say that about pretty much most of the crew.
Well, that's it for this week. Join us in 7 days when we'll have Frank Bruno taking on arcade champion Paul Turner at Sonic Blastman. Well, that just whips up my appetite for the catfish and almond bake that's on the menu tonight. So we're off to have a little bit of that, and we'll see you next week. Good night.
And as we come to the end of the show, we get, interestingly, Dominic Diamond telling us what's coming up next week.
That was a bold move, given that I'm assuming they still film stuff out of sequence point.
We know for a fact they did, because we've got Tim Boone wearing two different shirts here.
Yeah, true. But it does show that they're actually working with a bit more of a structure and idea. And as the episodes begin to show, It looks like they're going into this season with a plan.
Yeah, particularly around the celebrity challenges. They have mapped out which celebrities we're doing on which episodes. I do feel certainly with that way, because they tell us that Frank Bruno is going to be on the show next week.
Oh, legend.
Yeah, absolutely. And tonight we are having catfish and almond bake. We'll see you in 7 days.
Tasty.
Tasty.
Difficult fish to cook, a catfish.
I don't think I've ever had it.
Here we are, cooking tips. There's an issue with some fish because catfish, particularly a lot of the freshwater kind, are bottom feeders. And so you have to be very careful when you're cleaning them, because obviously where they're bottom feeders, they will get a lot of silt and sand. And otherwise you can end up with literally a muddy fish.
Oh,
yeah.
There you go. So that was the episode. A lot to dive into with episode one of this show, because you had like the big bit, the big joke at the start. And then three challenges and your reviews and your consultation to get in. But I feel like the problem is that we spend so much time wasted on the joke. It's like 2 minutes worth. And then you've got 60 seconds worth of credits. So you've lost 3 minutes of your already short runtime.
They really love that opening title sequence because it doesn't get any shorter.
No. But what did you think of the episode overall?
Only one challenge out of three really tickled my fancies. The Street Fighter challenge. Yeah. Even though it wasn't great Street Fighter playing by modern standards, it was great to see, especially because this was showing a game that I would be able to own. That was a big thing. Johnny Rock failed through no real fault of the celebrity. I mean, yes, he died, but the game mechanic itself was at fault because you have to go through the sequence again and again and again. And even that is a technical limitation because it's a Laserdisc game, which means that what happens is it skips back to the start of the chapter. Dragon's Lair, I'd say that didn't tickle my fancy. It maybe stroked it slightly because it is a beautiful looking game. The animation quality is tip top. The voice acting is great. And if he'd won, I think I'd be going, 2 out of 3 challenges really appealed to me. But as a result, he didn't, and it kind of left a bit of a wet squib at the end.
Yeah, I got to agree. It really is. It's only the Street Fighter 2 challenge that I got a kick out of here. And as you say, although it is bad Street Fighter playing, it's 1991/2, well, probably 92 at this point. It's 92 era Street Fighter playing. So I actually got a real big nostalgia kick out of people, quote, being the best at Street Fighter while at the same time not being good at Street Fighter.
It was a nice little trip down memory lane. And I think also while you've just been saying that, my brain just twigged what the issue was with the other two challenges. It was two quick time based challenges.
That's exactly the same thing.
Yeah. One uses a gun, but at the end of the day, it's still waiting for you to make an action or fail to make an action.
Yeah.
In following a predetermined path. There's no skip back, there's no skip forward, there's no warp zones, there's nothing that can really make it an exciting experience to watch.
Yeah, I was gonna say, it would be like if they had done a whole episode where you played nothing but Street Fighter 2. Good luck when we get to series 3.
Yeah, I was gonna say, you're tempting fate a bit there. Let's look at the positives.
Yes.
While a little long, the fake out intro was a lot of fun,
made me laugh, and it worked.
Yeah, definitely worked. The new budget, the bigger intro.
Yes.
The scale of the thing. He may hate it. I like the red coat look from Dominic Diamond. I think it's a great and also somewhat unexpected turn. I mean, wearing the waistcoat and white shirt in the church, that was suitably gothic. Holiday camp on an oil rig, that's out of left field. That's kind of a weird Butland City of Lost Children thing going on. But I like it. The reviews are still snarky. The consultation zone is still charming and entertaining. And the show feels like I remember the show being, which is hundreds of rabid kids screaming while gameplay goes on.
It's a total level up.
It is. It's a total level up. So score-wise, I'm not going to be too harsh. I'm going to give it 75%.
Okay.
I was originally going 70, but then again, as I think has happened a couple of times, while I'm just going through my afterthoughts, I'm like, no, I'll give it an extra 5. Because what it lacks in challenges, it makes up in just going at it full barrel.
Yeah. Do you know what? You might have talked me around there, because like you, I had it lower. I actually wrote down 60% originally, which I know sounds low, but it's only because there's one challenge in there that I liked. And as I said, the big problem with the episode is that 3 to 4 minutes of it are wasted on a joke and credits. So your review zone is shorter. But then the more I think about it, I like the Sonic 2 preview that we got. And I really, really like that Street Fighter 2 challenge. And I just love the setting. So that does kind of influence my score somewhat. So I actually am going to up it, but I'm still in that 60s period. I'm going to go for 68%.
Better than 60, not quite giving it the dignity 69.
No, do you know what? Because you've talked me into this before and I'm not going to have it happen again. No, we can't. Do you know what? 69. Nice. So we're going to go off now and have us some catfish and almond bake that Ash is preparing, because apparently it's very difficult.
You can eat it. I can't eat it. I'm allergic, mate. This is going to be a thin pickings on the menu for me.
I'm vegetarian, mate. It's terrible for me.
We can have the almond. You don't have an almond allergy, do you?
No, I'm okay.
Awesome.
But we'll see you in 7 days.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.